Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
Regular listeners to Research on Religion will undoubtedly be aware that our podcast has featured a number of economists, including Mark Vanderwerf, Dan Hungerman, Ellie Berman, Michael McBride, and Timur Kuran. For many of you, this might come as a surprise. Normally, the study of religion is confined to religious studies programs, divinity schools, or the departments of history, anthropology, sociology, and, occasionally, political science. Indeed, if you want to know something about religion, the last person you would think about asking would be an economist. But this is changing. Beginning several decades ago, a handful of sociologists and economists, most notably Rod Stark, Roger Finke, and Larry Iannacone, began analyzing religious behavior in institutions through the lens of microeconomic theory, sometimes called exchange theory or rational choice theory. Since that time, this theoretical perspective has caught the attention of a multitude of researchers in various fields across academia. There are sufficiently enough scholars studying religion with this approach now that they can host their own annual conference attended by several hundred scholars. To understand what economic theory can tell us about religion, I am pleased to have with us on the phone Larry Witham, who recently penned a book about the history and findings of this school of thought. That book is entitled Marketplace of the Gods, How Economics Explains Religion, and is published by Oxford University Press. Larry is a 21-year veteran of the journalism profession and a popular author of 12 books, with another one on the way. These books include such titles as A City Upon a Hill, How Sermons Changed the Course of American History, The Proof of God, The Debate That Shaped Modern Belief, The Measure of God, Our Century-Long Struggle to Reconcile Science and Religion, and Who Shall Lead Them? The Future of Ministry in America. He has just a number of other titles as well, too. He also has a couple fictional novels in his repertoire and is currently working on a book about attending art school, which is due out later this year. We'll link to Larry's website where you can find information about all these books, and so we encourage you to check out our website as well. So please make sure to visit Larry and tell him that Research on Religion sent you. Larry, welcome to Research on Religion.
Pleasure to be here.
All right. I'm going to have to be forthright here and mention that this interview is going to be an interesting one for me. I need to disclose that I happen to be one of the partisans of the Economics of Religion School, and I've been working in that field for about two decades now, which makes me one of the more early adopters of this theoretical perspective, if we don't take it all the way back to Adam Smith. So early 90s, I started working from this angle here. And like a lot of the recent pioneers in this field, such as Stark, Finke, and Iannacone, who I owe a lot of my thought to, I certainly have taken my fair share of criticism for taking what many consider to be a very narrow and perhaps sterile view of religion. So if I sound a little bit defensive during the interview, you'll know where I'm coming from. Anyways, I chose Larry Witham to do this podcast because his book, Marketplace of the Gods, was written from an objective outsider's viewpoint. He has nothing personally at stake in this approach or the debates that surround it, so I think he can offer a pretty fair assessment of what this approach is all about, including both the explanatory power of economic theory and its limitations. But before discussing the theory specifically, I have to ask you, as an outsider of this approach, and it's a pretty esoteric economic or a pretty esoteric academic topic here, what motivated you to write this book? I mean, this isn't necessarily a topic that generates bestsellers on the New York Times book list.
That's true indeed. Well, I enjoy researching and writing books, and I've been trained as a writer for the past 30 years. I left the news business, and in journalistic training, you look for the scoop, and it occurred to me that no one had yet done a popular book on a new trend, and so I had to formulate the idea, persuade my agent, and then find a publisher, and that worked out. There is a bit of a personal agenda, though I still consider it objective. I came out of college in the 70s when we thought a new era or a new age was upon us, so I became interested in religion, or the spiritual search, as we called it back then.
Mm-hmm.
And so for the past 30 or 40 years, I've read extensively on the topic and ended up interested in its theories, probably beginning with psychological theories of religion and history of religion, but eventually moving to the politics of it. And in the past couple decades, I've done a lot on science and religion. So moving to an economic theory of religion was just sort of a natural course. I was curious about what it said, and at the time I wrote the book, scholars such as you, Tony, and your predecessors had matured the field enough that a journalist like me could come in and try to sum up what it was all about.
Was there any book or article that you stumbled across or something written in the newspapers? Because, again, we feel like we're a pretty esoteric field, so to have somebody writing a book about this approach is pretty amazing. Did somebody pass you this book, or do you remember at all where you first encountered it?
You know, these debates were occurring in the public in the early 80s. They're popular debates because we were covering them in newspapers, and most of it was about religious groups commenting on different economic models for American society. So you had the Catholic bishops speaking of a more sort of collective and New Deal kind of economics, and then you had the neoconservative religious groups supporting supply-side economics. And in this debate, it was mainly, you know, the moral judgment on economic systems, but in that debate, theologians were talking about how economics explained how we live, what the human being is, and how we live. So that was in the back of my mind. And then in the, 2003, 4, 5, there was a trend in popular trade books about how economics explains about everything. And a lot of your listeners have heard about Malcolm Gladwell, who essentially was a journalist who took, behavioral economic models and wrote pop psychology books. And these are selling millions of copies.
Right.
So honest, and then the more specific economic books, Freakonomics and the like. So I thought, well, maybe there is a popular market for a book purely on an economic model of religion, which mostly quotes scholars, which, as you said, doesn't lead to bestsellers usually. But these other books prove that there is a chance. So I dedicated myself for a year to this book, and it's out and it's readable.
It's an extremely readable book. It's a really fun book too, because not only does it cover the ideas that this theoretical school proposes, but it also deals with the history of it. So it adds a lot of the personalities and the flesh to the theoretical skeleton to it. So excellent read, and I urge people to. In fact, my class on religion and world politics will actually be reading it this winter. So you'll get a number of sales there. Did you have any difficulty pitching this sort of book to a publisher? Now, you went with Oxford University Press, which is an academic publisher, but did they look at you and say, I don't know about this topic?
It was a tough sell. I had an agent, and we went to trade publishers, and at the title, Economics and Religion, religion books sell very, very good. How-to economic books sell very, very good. So a lot of the trade publishers thought, okay, great, I want to see it.
Mm-hmm.
But when they looked at it, they realized it was scholars debating theory. And I tried mightily to find, the economics of religion does have a practical application. There is a how-to aspect to it.
Mm-hmm.
We can go into that. But at first blush, for example, the Malcolm Gladwell books, essentially they're about how to get money in girls. You know, it's a how-to book on economic behavior, but I couldn't find that in the economics of religion. The other thing is that there wasn't any dominant, colorful personality. Like with the theory of physics, you can write a biography on Einstein,
right,
and you can sell a good book on the biography of Einstein, but there's no such figure in the economics of religion.
Mm-hmm.
It's a confluence of great thinkers of the past and then more contemporary thinkers who are, because they're more recent, they're not famous necessarily.
Right.
And so you have to make these people interesting and show how these ideas gathered together. And indeed, they've created controversy not only in scholarly circles, but in, you know, in to a degree in newspaper headlines.
Yeah, I noticed we've been getting a number of other press clippings from places like the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. So those have started appearing, and it is kind of interesting seeing some of your really good colleagues who, again, you feel are in an esoteric niche in academia appearing in the Wall Street Journal. It's like, hey, yeah, I know that guy. So, which is always kind of neat. You mentioned, too, when you're selling this book to publishers, it was a difficult pitch because they're thinking, oh, economics of religion, that's going to be how churches use money or how they might be corrupt or something along that line, which is when I tell people what I do, usually the first notion that come to people's minds. Before plunging into your own research, did you have any preconceived notions about what this economic approach to religion might be?
Well, you're absolutely right about the first impressions. In writing religion books, generally you have to write books that please that preach to the choir,
mm-hmm.
you know, that reinforce people's religious beliefs, and then you sell a lot of books to this religious group or that group. Or on the other extreme, you can say religion is baloney and write a strong atheist book, and then you can sell that book to all the atheists who don't like religion. But if you tiptoe in and say, well, religion's kind of complicated, and let's look at how we behave or think as religious people, it's very hard to sell because it's the comfort level is not as great. And you're right, the first impression is economics of religion is how religions make money when they're actually preaching love, or economic scandals, you know, the Vatican Bank or the televangelist who fleeces his flock. And I knew about that,
mm-hmm.
But I pretty quickly saw the economic approach is about an interpretation of human nature, how people behave. And for the most part, the economic approach, it gives religion the benefit of the doubt. It doesn't fight over whether religion is true or not, whether it's biologically based or whether it's a Freudian illusion. It just says the fact is everyone has religion, and they always have. They have many kinds of religions. Let's look at how they behave once they have these beliefs. And at that point, the economic model sort of kicks in, and it's... it doesn't have to be threatening to religion.
I think that's a really good point to make, because this is something that I've had to struggle with a number of people as well. They see that the approach is very sterile. Oh, you're taking God out of it. It's just a series of mathematical calculations. In fact, in recent years, as more economists have jumped into this perspective, they've used more formal modeling, and they say, oh, you're just taking all the spiritual faith about it. And that's not necessarily what we're doing. We just basically take, as you say, people's beliefs as given, and we then figure out, well, what do those beliefs lead to? What kind of institutional representations, what kind of behavioral patterns do these things bring out in people? And so we're looking at a specific area of it. We don't necessarily look where those beliefs come per se, but although some people do. Did your thoughts change about this approach while you were doing your research at all? Were you somewhat skeptical going into it?
Well, you know, the my skepticism as a non-academic is always about academic fields developing a vast catalog of terms and categories
mm-hmm.
to talk about what to a lot of us seem like just normal things. You know?
Right, common sense.
Someone goes to a store and says, I'll buy a big orange for 10 cents rather than a small orange for 20 cents. But an economist can write a whole chapter on that with mathematical equations. So, you know, the normal person is skeptical about all those equations. And so that's what I had to overcome. And but I realized that the reason the economics of religion can be understood today is that scholars have put aside the mathematics. I mean, they have to do that for their doctoral dissertations. They have to do that for their academic papers. But when they come and talk to us, they can put the math aside and say, there's a sort of a give-and-take principle going on here, and here's how you can analyze it. And you can look at it in terms of how you behave, or you can look over across the street and see how that other group's behaving. And it's interesting. It doesn't make you money, or it doesn't, you know, solve your personal problems, but it does give you a way to understand how the world works and how religion works. So that's you have to be curious to go this direction, but it's satisfying once you get the whole model understood. Wrap your head around the whole economic model.
You know, one thing you just that struck me as you were talking and talking about the mathematical models that many economists use, and again, many of these economists and other students, sociologists and political scientists, have to use the mathematical modeling for their dissertation to prove that they have the mettle to make it in the field. But along with the popular economic books like Freakonomics or Steven Landsberg's Armchair Economist, that or Peter Leeson's Invisible Hook, a book about the economics of pirates, one of my favorite economic books of all time.
You know, there's a colorful story that can draw public interest in.
Absolutely.
And then you get to the nuts and bolts. So.
Yeah, and that's what I think a lot of the scholars in this perspective have done. They do the math in the background, but then they tell really intriguing and interesting stories through this. And we recently had Michael McBride on, who does a lot of the mathematical modeling of that, but he told just interesting visual stories of the Mormon Church and how it is organized, and that really connects with people. So for those of you who are curious about this approach and are feeling a little bit shy about jumping into it because you didn't do well in your microecon 101 course in college, jump right into it. There's a number of really well-written books that explain this stuff fairly easily. Now, again, I'm speaking as a partisan of this approach. So let's before we talk about what this approach is actually saying, let's talk about the recent history of this perspective. And this is something I really like about the book, because it's not just a book about the approach, but it's a book about how the ideas took shape over several decades, if not hundreds of years. You take us back fairly deep in history to find out where this approach originated. So tell us a little bit about the history of this approach.
Well, as to the ancient past, you know the old saying, basically the Greeks all said it, in one way or another, right?
Mm-hmm.
But then we have to come up to the present, and basically it arises from the debate over what is human nature and how do human beings interact. And by the time of Adam Smith in the 18th century, he was applying this to the generation of wealth, how people work and produce things and sell things to each other, and why this creates more general wealth in the public. But he also was a moral philosopher, and he talked about how individuals feel sympathy towards other people, so they can sort of soften the greed of the marketplace by wanting to help their fellow man, especially their close relatives. And he talked about habit, how if you get in a good habit and you have ideas that reinforce that, you will be more economically successful. So that's been out there. And the current debate began after World War II. And essentially there are two views in sociology about human behavior. One was that all individuals are products of their group. So whatever norm your group has is what you will adopt as the individual.
Mm-hmm.
And that was, that's a certain sociological model called functionalism. And the alternative was that the best way to understand human society is to look at the individuals and build up from the individual. One person meets another person, they make an agreement, then those two people meet a third person. Eventually you have groups of people making social contracts, and then you have groups. So there's two different approaches. The group approach was sociology, the individual approach was economics. And in the 70s, sociologists and economists finally got together and said, we'll work with the individual approach and we'll start to discuss this in terms of religion as well. And so that's the recent beginning. And we have, names like Rodney Stark, who came from the sociology side. He believed in the individual was the beginning point for sociology. And Larry Iannacone, who studied under
Gary Becker,
who also said the individual was the beginning of economics. And so Stark and his colleague and Iannacone came together and developed, this is Iannacone's term as the economist, the economics of religion. And it begins with the individual, builds up through the family, then goes to the small group, and then it goes to the larger marketplace. And in that way, it shows how economics touches on every level of life, and therefore every level of religion. Personal belief, what the family believes in the household, the group that the family belongs to, the sect or the church, and then how all these religions relate to each other in a society, whether it's American society or the history of European religion or religions in Asia. The names are not yet famous, but the specialists know them, right?
And right. Now, Rod Stark really was one of the founders of this, and he's he comes from the sociological perspective, and in many ways was bucking the trend back in the 1960s by talking about individuals. He's doing a number of survey research projects at the time with his colleague Charles Glock. And he started thinking about this more and more in the 70s. And as you mentioned, there's, Larry Iannacone is approaching this from another angle, from another stream. And these two came together by the late 1970s or early 1980s, discovered one another and said, wow, this is, put these two approaches together. And we get the Economics of Religion school by the mid-1980s, I would say.
And they've been in the academic trenches for some years, and as probably we all know, in the academic world there are a lot of factions and a lot of different theories that professors are allied to. And when a new theory comes along, and this is normal science, you challenge it, you attack it, and see if it'll stand up. And even if it stands up, the professors don't like each other because of their different theories.
Oh, yeah. Oh, yeah.
And so this is, again, part of the outsider view when we look into academia. But the nice thing about the people who are approaching the economics of religion now is they're basically positive about religion. They don't say things like, I can prove that God exists, or you need to save your soul. They say that religion is a very productive thing in human life, and the people who attack religion are—they're not appreciating how much religion has built culture, helped individuals, even generated economic improvement in the world.
Mm-hmm.
And so they do get some resistance to that from professors who think, no, religion is unproductive, it's fantasy, it's regressive, it's primitive.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that kind of debate, and that makes the story fun to read about. Whoever you are, you can cheer for one side or the other.
Yep. And, let me go ahead and ask you about the actual approach itself. What is the basic idea behind the economics of religion? Is there a common strand of analysis that links a lot of these studies by Stark and Iannacone and Finke and Berman together?
Yes, well, the nice thing about the economic approach and what appealed to me was it has a very simple premise, and that premise is almost uncontestable. It's that human beings make choices, And when they compare things in choices, they usually try to make the most beneficial choice. And this, in economics, is called cost-benefit analysis, but you could look at it from a psychological point of view. You could look at it in terms of networks of human relations. So that's the basic premise. And but in life, you can't have everything you want. There are constraints. There's only so many hours in the day. We all eventually die, so we have to make choices with what's available. And this is the give and take of economic theory, how we make those choices. And the economics of religion says that religion is a benefit. We decide that it's good to have an explanation of the world. It's good to have beneficent gods or spirits who can help us in life. And it's also good to think that maybe after this life there's something better to come.
Mm-hmm.
So that's in everyone's equation when they make these calculations in everyday life, at different stages of life, and especially as we approach old age and we have to think about death. So the economic model looks at this cost-benefit choice in a family. Let's say a young couple. They only have so much time and money, and they have a choice of their religion. They can be Hindu, or they can be Methodist, or they can be Roman Catholic. And they have to decide how much time they're going to spend studying their religion and volunteering in it, and how much they're going to spend making money and having other kinds of recreation. So that's the household economics of religion. And it gets very detailed, and you can make some predictions. And I think we are talking about people not liking this approach. This is where it does get pretty personal. You know, how much time does Professor Tony Gill spend at church, perchance, and how much does he spend, you know, hiking in the Great Northwest? And he has to make those trade-offs. The economic approach then moves on to groups, how religions form, and the cost-benefit principle of how religions seek membership and resources, and also how they compete with other religions.
Let me stop you right there.
Yes.
Let's go move back to the household religion aspect. And what you do at the beginning of your book is really nice. You set up a number of different puzzles that economists of religion scholars have been thinking about for some time here. And you're right. They move from the household level up to the group level and then up to the marketplace level. So let's kind of play around still at this household level. And as you're mentioning, I want to take you back a little bit and talking about how religion in many ways is seen as a benefit. And from my perspective, this is a really important point to emphasize, because when people hear economists talk, they normally think that they're talking about money, that when it comes to maximizing benefits or optimizing your best choices, people are always doing it with money in mind. But you made this point, and it's a very subtle point, is that we maximize a lot of different things. We maximize time with friends, or in the case of religion, it could be these answers to life and death. We human beings have an innate curiosity about the world around them. Where did we come from? Where are we going? Why do good things happen to bad people and bad things happen to good people, such as that? And those are benefits too. Those are much more difficult to quantify than, say, money. It's, in fact, most economists tend to focus on the money aspect or financial economics because it just tends to be easier to measure. We keep a lot of data about that. But
yeah,
this other stuff, that's a little bit more difficult. And when you were talking about making choices under scarcity, Iannacone wrote, I think, a very good paper about the household allocation of time and effort in these churches, and found that when two people from different religions get married, they immediately find there's a resource problem in the household. That, well, you know, there's a Roman Catholic and there's a Lutheran. Well, on Sundays, they drive in different directions. And then when they have children, they have to decide, okay, are we going to send the kids to the Catholic Mass this morning, or are we going to go to the Lutheran services? And it quickly becomes apparent that it's very difficult to maintain that lifestyle. And as you mentioned, it's really personal. When you talk about people's religious decision, they talk about it as a deeply personal thing. But one of the things that goes on in the household that Iannacone found was that realizing that you're driving in two different directions on a Sunday morning, you're eventually going to gravitate toward one or two of these religions. It tends to be the person who has what he calls the most religious capital, and that usually tends to be the woman in the household who has attended church more likely than not than the man throughout the life course. And typically you see that, and it's kind of interesting because personally, on my own personal level, I've had uncles and aunts who, growing up Catholic, have married into Protestant families, and you see that. You see the people drifting away to the Protestant side because, well, you know, the wife that they married is much more religious, has been going to this Lutheran service. So at one point in time, you think, yes, this is a very personal decision that you might have a lot of thought about, and it might generate a lot of angst in your own personal mind in that. But on another level, yeah, there are these simple cost-benefit things that push us in one direction or the other.
Yeah, there's a view out in the humanities that it's okay to have several different levels of understanding about how the world works. You can have your scientific level, you can have your poetic level, and then you can have your religious level. And so to say that a family goes through cost-benefit analysis when it decides about its deepest commitment to one religion or another is not to deny that maybe, you know, the deities have indeed persuaded you to the true religion. You just have to realize that on another level you are making a cost-benefit analysis. And the economic term that might seem offensive in this case is efficiency. And it's, you know, if you say religion is like getting more or less money, that's very offensive. But if you say religion is efficiency, that can be offensive too, but really that's what it's about. It's how to get the most out of all the resources you have in a household, and that's the definition of efficiency.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. And one of the odd critiques that I have experienced throughout my career is that, well, you know, that economic rational choice thinking applies very well to people on Wall Street who are dealing with stocks and bonds on a daily basis. They want to make more money. But it doesn't apply to people in the religious environment, and you could think of this as clergy too. And you stop and think about that. I say, well, they exist in worlds of scarcity too, and they have to try to be, as you say, efficient. That, you know, their efficiency might be different than the one on Wall Street, but they're thinking, how do I make the best use of the volunteers that I have in my church? How do I make the best use of my missionaries? Should I send them, you know, abroad to Africa, or should I keep them in the local community? And we, you know, people are donating less this last year because of the recession. How are we going to manage our funds? Do we direct them to the youth group? Will that have a bigger impact on reaching more individuals for our faith? Or do we put them into the music group or someplace else?
You know, one of the most enjoyable chapter I did in the book is about the risk factor in religion. And, of course, there's a whole literature about how human beings view all of risk in life and how we have this new industry called risk management. And then, of course, we have in history this famous religious thinker, Pascal, who wrote the famous wager. And he said, if you have two choices, that God exists or God doesn't exist, and the consequences of those, either heaven or hell. And he was a mathematician. He pioneered mathematics, and he knew how to roll the dice in gambling. And Pascal said the better bet is that God exists, and then you know, you live accordingly. Well, we know risk is not that simple now. You don't have black and white calculations. But in every individual life, you know, in our heart of hearts, in the back of our heads, wherever, we calculate, if I'm going to commit myself to this religion or this moral behavior or whatever it might be, there's a risk factor. Am I going to end up better off? Am I going to be able to avert certain problems in life if I commit this way? Or I might believe that none of that is worth it. No sacrifice is worth an uncertain future. So I won't follow religious rules, for example. So I think if people look at themselves individually, they can find something of this this wager going on in their life.
Yeah, that's a very good point. That throughout my process of studying this approach, I've been very self-reflective of a lot of these things. As you mentioned, Blaise Pascal's wager and that. I sit down and I think, well, is that really going on in my head here? And being myself a rather risk-averse individual, I said, yeah, that kind of thing is going on. So it is kind of neat to, and again, I encourage people to pick up your book and read it and just think about their own life experiences and how this factors into that, because your book is written in such a way that it really enhances that. Let me go ahead and take it to our next level. So we talk a little bit about the household and individuals here. As you mentioned in your book, and you start the book with a number of different puzzles here that really reflect the household level, and we talked a little bit about that, and then the group level or the church denominational level. What are some of the findings at this level in terms of how religions form and what religions do pretty well and succeed or don't succeed?
Yes, it's at this level that we start hitting up against the economic terminology. But actually, this terminology is pretty easy. And the two big terms in economics that help us understand religion as groups is the club, and the other is the firm. I'm sorry. So these are very commercial economic terms. But the point is that a club is a small group that has exclusive entry into it. To be a part, you have to be very committed. But also, you get all the benefits of that club. And people who don't contribute to that club really can't get in and share the benefits. And this is a direct parallel to what we see in the history of small religious groups, the more intense ones, which are called sectarian groups or cult-like groups. They're smaller, they're very intense, and you're either in or you're out. Mm-hmm. And that's just like the economic club. Eventually, a club, a small group, may expand, and it may have a core membership, but it'll let a lot of people walk in off the street and start doing business with it. And this is the concept in economics of the firm. And the firm has one purpose, and that's to survive, mm-hmm. to sell its goods and services to a growing number of consumers to get resources and to survive and grow. And so the firm is a direct parallel to what we see in history of the religious institution. In the West, traditionally called the church, but Asian and Western religions all have institutions with a structure of teachers or priests, and then administrators, and then the followers. And economics explains how the club and the firm give economic models for how sects and new intense religions form in history, and also how very large institutional religions, the United Methodist Church and the Catholic Church, the two biggest Christian bodies in the United States, how they function, why they grow sometimes, why they decline other times, and every other detail.
Let me take you back, and the terminology that you use here, again, it is oftentimes turns off a lot of individuals in this approach, because you mentioned, well, the club is like the very beginnings of a church, the sectarian movement or the cult or something along that line, and eventually becomes a firm. And you mentioned that these firms sell their wares. And when people hear that, that's when their minds originally go back to the issue of money. They say, oh my gosh, you just think religious institutions are a front for making money, another way to maximize profits and to, soak individual consumers out there and take their money away. In fact, I know some of my colleagues early on when I were doing this who were not very pleased with religion or wanted to, show how, from a cynical side, that it was harming society, really pat me on the back saying, oh, good job, you're finally exposing them for selling all this religion stuff. But in reality, this goes back to the understanding of what economics really is about, is maximizing utility. Well, we don't specify what that utility is that for churches, it's not necessarily making money, but it's reaching a broad number of individuals. So instead of a profit motive, P-R-O-F-I-T, as you would see on Wall Street, it's more of a prophet motive, P-R-O-P-H-E-T, of trying to reach as many people with the word of God that you possibly can. And I think most churches, except for maybe small Gnostic denominations or ones that are ethnically based, really try to do. You have a great idea about what God is and what life is all about, and you want to share that with people, and that is essentially, quote unquote, what you're selling.
Yeah, and there are economic models to explain why churches actually help society.
Mm-hmm.
If a religion were not institutional, if it was just me and my religion walking around on street corners saying, "Hello, would you like to be a member of my religion?" And we had a billion of these all over the world, arguably there'd be very little social benefit. But economics says that business doesn't go this way. Business develops firms. So when religion becomes a firm, it provides a lot of services that governments don't have to provide, so it saves the public, you know, money, and it often provides them free, like, you know, food for the poor or counseling or education for young people. Also, religions organize people and socialize them, so they learn how to be civilized
mm-hmm.
human beings in smaller groups in the larger structure of society. And the list could go very long, and it has economic rationale, but it's really the essence of what religious institutions do. And then finally, of course, as you said, if a religious institution said it was totally unselfish, and let's say one day it went up to Wall Street and on the auction block the Catholic Church sold every piece of property and building and dispensed every dollar it had in the bank, the Catholic Church could not do anything anymore for society. You know, everyone would have a few more dollars in their hands, perhaps, but you've lost the services of that institution. So it can't do that. No religion that's rational would liquidate itself and say, this is unselfishness. Have I made that point? It's a little bit bizarre, but...
Well, it's actually a very good point, and this is reminding me of the recent release of Robert Putnam's book, American Grace, which discovers this, and actually I think in many ways he rediscovers what a lot of sociologists have known over time. But Putnam had written a book about a decade ago called Bowling Alone, where he decried the loss of civic engagement and civil society in the United States, and a lot of us in religious studies were waving our hands saying, oh, you forgot about churches. In his most recent book, he really discovers this. Yeah, churches do a lot of these things. They provide charitable giving, and many of us might know about soup kitchens or food pantries. But also, as you mentioned, churches organize and socialize individuals, provide them, and he finds this in his book, and other scholars have found this as well, that when people are engaged in a religious institution, they become more engaged in other areas of civil society that are not necessarily connected to religion. They are trained to organize things, and so they become part of the fabric of society, which is very beneficial. And this works in some, in different ways or in reverse sometimes too. We just had a podcast with Dan Hungerman, who talked a lot about how churches provide some of these social activities, and then when governments step in to do some of this, or when other types of activities such as NFL football and during the fall steps in, people stop going to church, and some of that in part is lost there. So I'll direct some folks to those podcasts if you're interested in that. Let's take it to the final level. We talked about the household level. We talked about the group level. And the last level that economists turn to, again, it's up one more level of aggregation, is the societal level, or what they term to be the market level. What's going on there?
Well, that was probably the earliest insight about the economics of religion. And that went back to Roman times. Rome was a pluralistic religious society when Christianity was born, and then they had the first Christian emperors, and those Christian emperors, and they had different kinds of Christian emperors, They had to decide what policy would we have, only one religion, or would we let all the different religions sort of compete with each other? And so even back then, there were statesmen saying we should have a marketplace of religions, because what that does is it lets everyone find God in their own way, and also the competition makes people more serious and more excellent in their religion.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas if you impose one big state religion, everyone's going to become lukewarm. Adam Smith picked this argument up when he looked at the state churches, the state Catholic Church, the state Presbyterian Church, and he said the small sectarian groups, sort of like the early Methodists, who lived simple lives, they were very evangelistic, very enthusiastic, were winning more converts because they were like PT boats rather than battleships. They could they could maneuver and move around, and so the idea of religion in the marketplace has been with us for a long time.
Yeah, let me stop you there and just emphasize the point about Adam Smith, because we talked about him earlier, that we think of Adam Smith as being the free trade guy, Wealth of Nations. Few people remember the theory of moral sentiments outside of the field of moral philosophy or economics. But he did, in The Wealth of Nations, have an entire chapter that was largely devoted to religion. Now, it wasn't called religion. You can't go, run to your shelf right now and pick up your abridged version of Wealth of Nations.
It's Education, way in the back of his giant volume.
Exactly. It was Adult Education. And unfortunately, many of the abridged versions of The Wealth of Nation, that chapter is the first one to be cut. And so if you have an abridged version of it and you're saying, Tony, Larry, you're silly. He didn't write anything about religion. You won't find it in those abridged versions. You have to go to the full large volume set of The Wealth of Nations. But it's there.
And he argued, I think we know Adam Smith for the idea of the invisible hand. Well, he only used the word twice, it turns out. But so it's a little bit of a myth. But he was basically saying that the way the market works, if you allow as much freedom as you can, then some people will be very enthusiastic and very successful, and they will gather more people around them, and then other people will see that, and they will compete and try to also be enthusiastic and successful, and the general result is that you have more enthusiastic and successful people doing, making things and selling them, and I'll make this hammer, and if you can make that barrel, and we'll exchange them, and the hammer and the barrel get better, and more people get them.
Mm-hmm.
This can be applied to religion, and so the economic approach is basically a free market, and here's some of the lingo, a supply-side view, that the more freedom you have for religion to be enthusiastic and excellent, the more chance people have to adopt a religion and improve their lives. But what you have is a very tumultuous marketplace. A lot of competition, you get extremes, very ardent sectarian groups, what we call fundamentalist groups these days, and then you have long established religious institutions that want to keep their membership, but they get a little bit slower because they're big and they have a bureaucracy and they have a lot of overhead costs, and they can't compete with the little ones who are sort of out on the street talking to their members after church saying, no, why don't you come join our group?
And I have to stop you there because in my own research, I had a very explicit example of that when I was talking to a bishop down in Latin America talking about Protestant groups. And he explicitly said, listen, the Protestant groups have an advantage over us because they're very small and nimble, and they can just set up church in a storefront or in a gymnasium, whereas we, the Catholic Church, have these huge overhead costs and have to maintain these large cathedrals, and boy, that just isn't fair. And so he used very explicit terminology to discuss this type of, or I should say very explicit economic terminology to discuss this competition between religious groups that he saw going on in Mexico. And what's really interesting from my vantage point on this is that when it comes to talking about this economic perspective, I get more skepticism from scholars than I do actually from clergy members who, when I tell them this approach and they say, oh yeah, you know, that's how things operate. We're in a world of scarcity and we got to make these decisions and there's these competitors here and we're very big and slow and there's these very, you know, small and nimble churches and we got to figure out ways to get better or more efficient.
Yeah. Well, there's good reason for people to be skeptical about the marketplace and capitalism.
Mm-hmm.
Because we do have, you know, we do have hucksters, we do have people on Wall Street who are corrupt, and we're just overwhelmed with advertising. So this whole idea of a marketplace is very wearying after a while, especially when you think about religion. But is there a better alternative? And history seems to suggest that no. You will have big majority religions, but the more freedom of religion you have, the more people will be served, the more moderation will be generated overall in the society. If let's say if one had to argue the moral benefits of the economic approach to religion, there's probably two, and one of them is this marketplace level, and that's to say that religious freedom is good. If a nation state allows as much religious freedom as possible, they're allowing an open market, and this allows the citizenry to let off a lot of steam. It allows innovation. It allows people who are enthusiastic and excellent to have a chance to present, you know, religious goods and services,
mm-hmm.
and it does help the society develop. And then, just as an aside, the other moral point is that I think individually a lot of religious people struggle with the concept of altruism. You know, how much should I sacrifice to be a good Christian or a good Muslim or a member of the Jewish people? And this is an everyday question. How much money should I give? Should I give my free time? Should I forget about my idea and accept the idea of someone else? So the economic approach says that to be altruistic, you can also be seeking self-benefit. If you go along with someone else's idea, the cooperation benefits you. If you give money or if you give free time, you feel better because it conforms to your faith and builds stronger bonds with that that group. And if you follow a religious rule that you believe in, well, then maybe you will get a benefit after you die. And so to be unselfish is also to be selfish, and that's sort of the insight of the economic approach that very debatable, but it is one of the insights.
And it's interesting. It does show that the two can be intimately intertwined. And going back to Adam Smith, this was one of the lessons that he wrote about in the Theory of Moral Sentiments, that we are complex moral critters that have these mixed motivations that don't necessarily contradict all the time. Sometimes they may, but not necessarily all the time. I think you do a very good job of pointing that out. Let me talk about here in the minutes that we remain about some of the critics of this approach and or some of the critiques of this approach that you have encountered, and you devote some time in one of your last chapters to this. What are some of the main problems that people see with this economic approach?
Well, you know, one critic I cite is a very fine gentleman, Robert Wuthnow, who's a sociologist of religion at Princeton. And he said to me one time, you know, when you get into this world, you see two things. People say, no, life is simpler than you think, and there are people who say, no, life is more complex than you think.
Mm-hmm.
So the critics of the economic approach say you're being too simple, and the favorite term is you're reductionist. You're reducing warm, spontaneous, creative human beings, you know, poets all, to economic machines, and you're typing in the numbers and explaining how they work. So that's the main attack. It's sort of an emotional view of what the human being is. But as we've discussed, the economic approach is only that when you do it with, you know, mathematics in a textbook. When you discuss it as a model for human behavior, like a Malcolm Gladwell book might, or hopefully like my book might, it is full of human warmth, and it just looks at people are calculating behind all that human warmth. And they do it with religion also. The second attack is there's a whole history of the group view of sociology. Religion is a group experience. When we were primitive, we created the gods to unite us as a group. But now that we're not primitive, football is our religion. So we're all united by football. Mm-hmm. You know?
Not here in Seattle this year, though.
No offense to football fans. But
I've become a New England Patriots fan this year.
Okay.
So.
Yeah. And so that's the functionalist view of religion. And so this view is very strong in the universities and the religion departments today.
Mm-hmm.
And when the economic view comes along and says, no, that's basically, that really doesn't explain much. You have to start with the individual who's, self-interested and wants the benefits of religion and then build up from there. That creates a storm within academia. And at the conferences and in the book reviews and everywhere else, you see this sort of lining up on both sides of the aisle and then, you know, firing cannon across. But I just say let a thousand flowers bloom. If a model has integrity and it's not total esoteric foolishness, then it's fair game. And the economic model is simple enough. It has integrity. It covers all the bases. But you don't have to believe in it, as I open the book. There's no urging here for people to convert to the economic model. It's just one more good way to understand our behavior.
I think that's a really good way to put it. And again, that's being a partisan of the economics approach. I oftentimes phrase it that way. We're adding another piece or a couple pieces to the larger puzzle, and it's not to deny a lot of these other aspects of religious behavior or explanations for religion. Of course, I do disagree with some of the explanations given, but I do see in many regards there are complementarities between the different approaches that are out there. And one of the things we're trying to do here in Research on Religion is to bring a lot of these approaches to the fore. Not surprisingly, I tend to favor the economic approach, but bringing other people have different ideas, and as you say, let a thousand flowers bloom. Speaking of flowers blooming, you are moving on to different fields and writing a new book that it sounds pretty interesting. I think in closing here, let us know what you're up to. You're writing a book on art school, is that correct?
Yes, I've just turned it in. It's with the University Press of New England. So I work with my agent, and we try to place these books in the big, trade publishers, so they're right out there with the John Grisham novels.
Mm-hmm.
But it never works that way, Tony.
I know. My first book, when I first got the first royalty check, I said, "Oh, I'm not selling 5 million copies. It's only 200." Oh, okay.
But you have to bite the bullet, and if you're going to do books that are a little bit more thoughtful and complex and a little bit esoteric, then you can't be the bestseller. So actually, in my undergraduate work, in graduate school, I studied religion, a master's in religion. In undergraduate work, I studied art, and I was a pretty good drawer and painter, and I would have gone into that field, but other things arose. So now in old age, I decided to do, real journalism again. I spent a year on the campus of an art school, a nationally known one here in Baltimore, a fly on the wall in all the classes. And I've written a book on a year in the life of an art school, all the people, the art world that it's part of, followed various students through their trials and tribulations of deciding whether they've really got what it takes to be an artist. And these are like 18-year-old to 22-year-olds, so you can imagine. I have a young son who was recently in college, so I know the age, but that's very young for me, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
But I got to know them, and I watched them day to day, and the book is called Art Schooled. And it you know, as with Marketplace of the Gods, I think it's a scoop. There's never been a book done like this before. Real eyewitness account of a real modern art college. So maybe you have some listeners who are into religion, economics, and fine arts.
I think that's a completely logical combination there. And I have to pitch this book as well when I was reading on your website of what you're doing. It's those kind of books, despite being an academic and doing all the theoretical modeling and that, it's those books where you immerse yourself in the topic as an observer and see how people are interacting, just are absolutely fascinating for me. So we wish you the best of luck with that. And when it comes out, I'm sure that I will be picking up a copy of it. And I hope a number of our listeners will. And again, we're going to direct you to all the different books that Larry Witham has written, including Marketplace of the Gods, on his website. So please make sure that you check us out at www.researchonreligion.org. Join the conversation. And Larry, thank you very much for being on Research on Religion.
It was a great pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.